back together again. You and I chatting it up Thursday style, the 24th of July, 2025 on Connecticut Today, where I open the show with thoughts on local and national reaction to a settlement between the Trump Justice Department and Columbia University over allegations of anti-Semitism and some civil rights violations. Republican State Senate Leader Steve Harding dropped by to chat about questions regarding some education spending in the state and maybe some budget sleight of hand. Milford native and NHL Hall of Fame broadcaster Dan Rusinowski talked about a charity golf tournament next week where he's one of the honorees. We welcome CBS News reporter Aaron Navarro in D.C. back on the show to detail the very latest concerning the ongoing Jeffrey Epstein controversy, while News Nation wrestling expert Kurt Bardella dropped by to talk about the passing in the legacy of wrestling legend Hulk Hogan. So I'm home last night in my suburban man's castle there, and I'm poking through the news, the local stuff, the statewide stuff, the national stuff, and I pull up a story, and I have parts of the story here, and it's quite fortuitous. We talked to one of our guests yesterday, Adam Kissel, regarding the feds, clamping down on some of these elitist universities, in particular Princeton and Columbia, and of course Harvard. Now Harvard seems to be the next in line because of some protests that happened at the ongoing, at the outset of the war that broke out after Hamas attacked Israel. And you know, these were not protests for peace. Jewish students were harassed. Jewish faculty members were harassed. You had guys like this Mahmoud Khalil, who's treated like Jesus Christ on the cross by some on the left. So Jews felt intimidated, Jewish faculty members, a lot of Jewish students, not only in New York, but all over. But we saw the video from New York, right? We saw that, everybody wearing the mask. Funny how the people on the left don't like masks, but they can wear those keffiyehs or whatever it is to hide their face. And they were hiding their face, chanting, you know, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, which is like chanting Heil Hitler. That's the modern Heil Hitler. So we saw all this. The bottom line is we saw all this happen months ago. And the Trump Justice Department and Mr. Trump said on the campaign trail, if I get reelected, this SH is going to stop. And for the schools that allowed this SH to continue, they're going to have to pay a bill. Well, guess what? That bill is going to cost Columbia. Now, who knows what it'll cost Harvard? But it's going to cost Columbia here $220 million. Plus, the feds are going to, monitor them and everything. So I said, well, that's interesting. And then usually when these things happen, when these kinds of stories happen, I say, you know what? I need a little entertainment. I do. So what do? I go to the New York Times, right, and I read the comment section on the New York Times. Because if you want to find a cadre, a cross section, a slice of people who are just suffering, I think. And one of my other questions is Trump derangement syndrome real? Seriously. I never thought it was. Now I'm starting to believe it. So I go to the comments section of the main story on this $220 million settlement between Columbia and the Trump Justice Department, the DOJ. So I find the story in the New York Times. So I don't bother to read the story because I've read the story seven or eight other places, and I figure, okay, I've got all the points. So what you can do if you're quick with the mouse, they will let you read the reader comments and still keep you on the paying side of the paywall. So I didn't care. I was not able to cross the paywall. I didn't need to read the Times point of view on this because I read USA Today, the New York Post, some local papers, whatever, the wire service story, AP. So bottom line is, I think I had a pretty good idea of what the story was about and the details, and we'll have them here. But sure enough, oh my God, you go to the comments section of the New York Times and you say to yourself, yeah, maybe Trump derangement syndrome is real. Maybe it is. I never thought it was. I thought it was a tongue-in-cheek thing, like, Trump derangement syndrome can't be real. I think maybe What is that that manual that psychologists and psychiatrists use, the DMSV that MDs use? I'm just trying to remember that off the top of my balding head here. I think we need an entry for Trump derangement syndrome in there. I really do. Now, you're probably asking, well, what did you see? I'll get into that momentarily. But what do you think? I'm sorry I have to start with this, but I'm reading these responses last night, and nobody seemed to care that these were some serious allegations of anti-Semitism. The big question was, gee, is Trump going to get the money? Who's he going to give the money to? Oh, my God, are people that stupid? Does Trump derangement syndrome actually exist? And what I mean by it is an inability to look clearly at the facts of a case because Donald Trump lives rent-free between your ears. And it doesn't mean you have to love the guy or hate the guy. That's not the issue. I'll tell you what I read coming back right here on WICC 203-333-9422-333-WICC. You tell me, Trump derangement syndrome. Does it exist? Do you see it in your family, among your friends? I'm starting to think it's real. And you've probably joked about it. Maybe your friends have said it. Your people that you go to church with or to a mosque or a synagogue or a temple. Maybe members in your own family. You sit there and laugh. Hey, Trump derangement syndrome. And you know what that is. That's kind of a colloquialism for people that won't even look at the merits of a case if it has to do anything with Donald Trump. Now, I don't think it's an actual psychological condition, but it might be. And the reason I bring that up is, and we'll get to some of these in a minute, I went to the New York Times last night and said, geez, I'll bet you there are some good ones over there. And there were more people there concerned about whether Trump was shutting down free speech or whether he was going to get the money with this settlement with Colombia, then there were people concerned with why Colombia got pinched because of all the anti-Semitism that they allowed. There's a chunk of the left that would rather deal with anti-Semitism and have that amongst their myths than using a clear-headed look at Donald Trump. I mean, it is mind-numbing. And I knew I'd find it there. And I know what you're saying. Well, geez, if you go to the New York Times, you're going to get the Upper West Side folks. Yeah, but it was still distressing. It's like, you know, a car accident with injuries is bad, but when you actually look at the injuries, you're like, no, that ain't good. But you didn't have to look at it, honey. I know, sweetheart, but we couldn't avoid it.
God, the guy's arm fell off.
Oh, stop it. You know what I'm talking about here. So, yes, I think Trump derangement syndrome needs to be, who would do that? The American Psychiatric Association? Because these people in the comments section of the New York Times last night, 95% of them were like, oh, see, Trump's Hitler. We're shutting down free speech. And about the 5% of people were sitting there going, well, you know, Colombia kind of allowed a lot of anti-Semitic stuff to happen on campus in their library. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Trump shouldn't do this. Is that how nuts the left is here? Seriously. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. And they're going to cry and moan again when Harvard has to pay up, because Harvard is going to have to pay up because even Harvard's president, who is a Jew, who is Jewish, said, yeah, we have a lot of anti-Semitism on my campus. But again, when the feds thankfully drop the hammer on Harvard and tell them you cannot allow Jewish students and faculty members to be harassed, that violates civil rights laws that were passed back in the 60s. There are going to be people who are going to be less concerned. The New York Times crowd and the Uber left crowd, they're going to be less concerned with the vile anti-Semitism on campus than they are with Trump. What is up with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the allowance of anti-Semitism here? What are you folks out of your minds? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. It's mind-numbing. I'm telling you, Trump derangement syndrome exists. Gary's in Bridgeport to start us off. Gary, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, Gary. What's on your mind?
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Is a human life worth the same regardless of the religion or ethnicity of the person?
Yeah.
So when we have like 60,000 Arab Palestinians mowed down in Gaza,
mm-hmm.
does that not pain every human being? Could that not hurt everyone equally to the slaughter that Hamas did on October 7th?
Well, Hamas should have thought twice before doing that. In other words, Hamas started a war, Gary. What did they expect? What did they expect was going to happen? What did they expect?
Wait, I asked you a question. You didn't answer it.
All right, ask it again.
Is when a Christian Arab is murdered by Israel bombing a Catholic church in Gaza, isn't that as tragic as a Jewish Israeli or a Muslim Arab dying?
No, Gary, I understand where we're going here. What does that have to do with Jews getting harassed on college campuses?
I don't think your premise is correct. I think
No. I'm asking you. No, Gary, I'm asking you. This was a discrimination decision saying that the civil rights of Jewish students and Jewish faculty members at some of these schools were not guaranteed by the school. Even the president of Harvard admitted there is a problem at his school. War is a horrible thing, Gary. I understand it. The thousands of lives lost of the Palestinians is a horrible thing. But you know what, Gary? We get an example even today where the Israeli government, the U.S. and others, I don't know whether you just heard the news at the top of the hour, they said, no, listen, Hamas is not serious about ending this. Forget the peace talks.
Well, here's the thing. It pains me for every human life that is taken, and whether it's Jewish, it's Muslim, it's Christian, they're all the same. They're all God's children. I don't care what you say.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what I'm saying. We are mischaracterizing who the aggressor is. For 75 years, Israel has taken the land of Palestinian Arabs and refused to give it back.
And how many times over those years, Gary, and believe me, I'm no scholar here, but I can read, and how many times over those years, and there are even people now within the U.S. government that are wondering how serious this is, where there have been negotiations and talks that have gone right up to the line, and all of a sudden, going back to Yasser Arafat and all these people, they back away at the end. When they are given and offered 90-95% of what they want, they say, nah, no, forget it.
Well,
yeah.
I'm not sure I see your premise there. And here's what I'm saying. Benjamin Netanyahu will not even entertain the concept of a two-state solution, which is the international law, that is the United States express legal opinion that the occupied territories need to be evacuated by Israel. That includes Gaza and the West Bank. But Netanyahu doesn't want to give them a single inch. They flip it around and say, oh, they don't agree with Israel's right to exist. I think Israel has a right to exist, but Palestine also has a right to exist. And, they're going to get a moth-eaten country, but give them a country. Stop bombing the crap. They're starving kids who are lining up for water and food and medicine. They're bombing kids who are lining up for water. How can America, which is based on freedom and human rights and democracy and equality of all peoples, pay for this genocide that's happening? It's ridiculous. And you're
Let me ask you something then. What role does Hamas play in this? You know, Hamas could have ended this war, the current one, months ago, Gary, and they could have said, you know what, the fighting has to stop. Let's all get together and figure this situation out. Why doesn't Hamas do that? Why don't they?
That's not the right question. You're framing it in a way.
No. I'm asking you a question. If the goal here, Gary, is to end the fighting and end the suffering, there was one side that can do that. There is one side.
We have agreed to a ceasefire repeatedly Israel backs out every single time. And the news media here completely misframes
Why doesn't Hamas release the rest of the hostages they have?
I don't represent Hamas.
Well, but the question is, well, no, if we're, if Gary, you're...
I can't speak to the terrorist organization.
Aha, you just, Gary, because they are terrorists, and they don't want this to end.
The 60,000 that have been murdered, of which two-thirds are women and children, are not terrorists.
Well, guess what? A lot, Gary, I do have to run, Gary. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. I really do, and let's continue this. Here's the bottom line. Yes, thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent people have been killed. Guess what? That happened in World War II, too, because it was a declared war. Should the killing stop? Of course it should. Of course it should. Could it have stopped months ago? Yes, it could have. Hamas doesn't want it to stop. You just heard it. Top of the hour news right here at WICC. All the sides in the Middle East and the U.S. are saying, hey, you know what? Yeah, they're not serious. They're not. Because their only reason for living, now maybe not for the kids and the wives and everything, but there is a significant chunk of people in the Middle East who make it their daily bread to hate Israel and hope it's going away. Now, I can't control what people think, but what I can say is this. Israel isn't going anywhere. They're just not. It's not going to happen. So listen, I understand like people like our last caller who are very ostensibly extremely legitimately concerned. I get that. Hamas attacked Israel. And yes, I know there are past grievances. I understand that. But they could have ended this thing months ago, and the adults could have gotten together with the adults and say, you know what? Israel's been around since 1948. And by the way, if you get a chance, read about the lead up to the Israeli issue and the 1948 presidential campaign. And by the way, there's a reason the other developed countries in the Middle East really aren't clamoring to come to the aid of the of Gazans and Palestinians. Research that, too. But I try to bring you the people that know what's going on in the state, like this guy, no stranger to the station, Republican State Senate member Steve Harding, who's here to talk about what many in the GOP caucus see as a little, I don't know, a shell game, a little three-card Monty game with maybe some education money. Hey, Steve, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
It's always good to be on with you, and thank you for your having me on your program. It's always great.
My pleasure, Steve. So tell my listeners today, what is the concern of the caucus here? And I know it has to do with some education funding and how that money is being presented here. Yeah, explain that, Steve.
Right. Yeah, so basically what's happening is the governor is essentially using early childhood education, which is broadly supported in a bipartisan basis, as a guise to allow him to create a slush fund with your taxpayer money. And so what he's doing is he's taking surpluses that, you know, per our guardrails and fiscal constraints, should be going towards paying down the record debt we have in the state, second highest debt per capita. He's taking that surplus instead and putting it every year annually into this off-budget fund that isn't under the confines of the spending cap or all these other things. So if you remember, Paul, and I know you do, and your listeners do leading up to last session, there was this robust discussion surrounding the spending cap because the Democrats inevitably and unsurprisingly wanted to spend well beyond what our legal spending cap requires us. And as we know, the spending cap is there to constrain the legislature from spending more than beyond our means, and inevitably leading us to record tax increases, which when we spend beyond it, not surprising to anyone, we have tax increases and record tax increases in many of those cases. So the Democrats and the governor were looking for some creative ways to get around this spending cap legally and to make it look like they're spending underneath it. And so what the governor did, and he used early childhood education, which I think is quite shameful, as this guise to take all this money from a surplus off budget, outside the confines of a spending cap. So now he's got $200 million sitting there in a fund that's gaining interest and gaining more money each year to spend how he and different individuals in his political sphere deem appropriate as it relates to, quote-unquote, early childhood education. It really is quite a shameful tactic on something that, you know, Republicans, Senate Republicans, we support. We actually had an initiative fall that would have spent the same amount of money, actually even more money, towards early childhood education, but did it within the confines of the budget. Make it a priority in the budget with transparency in the light of day for voters to vote on it. Don't do it in this manner that's been done here.
So, Steve, are you alleging then or saying flat out that the reason the governor did this was to say, hey, go ahead and oppose this stuff, try and oppose it, I'm still going to move it off budget because we know that any opposition to this just isn't going to wash well because people's eyes kind of glaze over, Steve, with how it should have been done. Do you think that was one of his motivations or not?
I have a hard time believing it's not. I mean, because it is a show game. I mean, he's someone that comes around and says that he supports the guardrails. But meanwhile, when you implement maneuvers like this where you're taking hundreds of millions of dollars in surplus that should be pursuant to the guardrails, spending down on our record debt here in the state, and you're using it and putting it essentially to a slush fund and calling it an early childhood fund. I mean, it's basic logic, I think, Paul, dictates that it's being done with the intent of moving money off budget. And again, the money, and even the governor would admit this, is now off budget. That $200 million and all the money that goes into it year after year after year, all the interest that's accrued from it, is now all outside of the budget, not outside the confines of the spending cap, outside all the confines of all the fiscal constraints that keep us fiscally responsible. And now all of a sudden the governor and the legislative Democrats have a pot of $200+ million gaining in funds every single year to spend how they wish, or at least it frees up $200 million in other areas that they could spend. And what I find shameful about this is it's under the guise of something that is broadly supported on a bipartisan basis, which is early childhood. And you know what? Remember, Paul, what the lotto was supposed to go towards?
Yeah.
Right. Or the tax on tobacco. You know, how is that going? Meanwhile, you know, Lotto is a great example, and it relates to this because it was supposed to be spent on education.
Yeah.
I don't think one dime of it is spent on education any longer. And so what I fear is that we're creating an off budget fund that is going to grow beyond $200 million, that the minute that the Democrats spend beyond their means and have a deficit at hand, that is going to be raided. And it's going to be spent on everything, frankly, other than early childhood. And these are the type of fiscal gimmicks that led us to back-to-back record tax increases in the 2010s era that we just got beyond, that the governor says he opposes, and then he does things like this that it runs antithetical to what he says financially or fiscally.
Is he doing this, Steve, final question here, is he doing this as part of, and you and I see this, whether it's members of the General Assembly or some of these push polls, is this in some way, shape, or form, Steve Harding, in your opinion, to basically acquiesce to the leftward-leaning elements of the Democratic Party, which Ned Lamont may need if he's going to run for a third term, as centrist as he is on some things here and vetoing some bills? Does he understand that he needs the left part of his party to win here or not?
You would have to think politically that that's what he's doing, because basically, yeah, I said this when he proposed his budget that broke a lot of the guardrails, even in his proposal, is the minute that you play gimmicks like this that allow yourself to spend hundreds of millions of dollars beyond the spending cap, just blatantly in the face of all the taxpayers, it basically sends a message to the legislature, go ahead and do what you wish. Play all the games and gimmicks you want to get around the spending cap and spend well beyond it and spend that taxpayer money beyond what we really should be spending. And I think it set a message the legislative Democrats and the far left of his party that we're no longer, he is no longer fiscally responsible. He is no longer fiscally centrist, that he is going to allow them to play gimmicks. He basically what I actually would have more respect for him, frankly, if he just came out and said, let's spend beyond the spending cap. Mm. I don't believe in it any longer. Let's just break it. But instead he does, he's too cute by half. He wants to say that he supports the spending cap, but then he plays gimmicks with hundreds of millions of dollars to spend beyond it and says, oh, well, it's off budget, so it's not really spending beyond the spending cap. But come on. We weren't born yesterday. The people in this state are smart. I think that they're going to see through this. And he also sent a strong message to the liberals of his party that he's willing to spend beyond our means.
I like how you borrowed one of the governor's favorite lines there, Steve. That was very good. I like how you went
doing it himself. I like to use people's own words, Paul.
Steve Harding. Steve, thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, thanks. Yeah. Too cute by half. That's one of the governor's favorites. I like that. Remember when it was not this time around, but last year or the year before. No, it was last year. Remember they tried to get that unemployment for striking workers through, and they didn't call it that. It was supposed to be tucked in a fund that was called like a assistance for low-income workers. And His Excellency, the governor, said, no, I'm not signing that because it's too cute by half. Yeah, speaking of Milford, how about one of Milford's own here? This guy has done pretty well for himself, longtime buddy of mine. We bond over hockey and racing and other things. Milford's own, Milford's native, Dan Ruzanowski, the current and only radio voice ever of the San Jose Sharks of the National Hockey League. He was the Foster Hewitt Award winner last year in the NHL Hall of Fame. Dan, it's Paul. How are you, sir? How you been?
Hey, I'm great, Paul. It's always great to talk to you and to visit with all my friends in Southern Connecticut.
Yeah, boy, Dan, remember those days of you and I at the old, with a tear in our eye, Dan, we remember the old New Haven Coliseum. And Dan, I can tell you, and when you're back in the area, you probably hear it too, how many people, Dan, when I'm at or doing Quinnipiac games or when I'm at or doing a Sacred Heart game now, invariably they say, hey, remember the Coliseum. I get that all the time, Dan. I do.
Well, absolutely. And it's not just, the hockey. I mean, it's all of the historic concerts that were there at the old New Haven Arena before that. But, it's such a big part of the fabric of life in Connecticut, the sport of hockey. And the fact that, it even goes back to the 1930s and 40s. And it's a strength that will always be there.
Yeah. And Dan, you like me, we cut our teeth doing college games, and I tell people, and they're fascinated. I say, yeah, well, friends of mine have done this. You did work for both what we call the North Country trip, Clarkson and St. Lawrence, right?
Yeah, I called St. Lawrence games for 7 years, and I actually went to both schools, which is kind of like going to Army and then undergraduate, then going to Navy graduate school. Yeah. They hate each other, but arch rivals. But I got a graduate degree at Clarkson, and I continue to call the St. Lawrence games. Just a great history up there.
Nice.
And, of course, everybody in Connecticut knows about them when they play in ECAC or interleague action.
Yeah. Now, we got a big deal coming up with you and another former Nighthawk broadcaster, Nick Nixon. You guys are going to be on hand for this golf tournament. I see it's coming up this Monday, the 28th. It'll benefits for the youth hockey in the area, in the greater New Haven area, at the Orange Hills tournament. How'd you get the Orange Hill course? How'd you get involved with this?
Well, Mark Dacola, who used to be the trainer for the Nighthawks, and after that, the Los Angeles Kings, is one of the organizers. And Jeff Russell, who's got a long history there in public relations and so forth, got in contact with both Nick Nixon and myself. And we're just very honored that that we're part of this. We understand that that high school hockey especially, but all sorts of youth hockey in the greater New Haven area needs to be supported, needs to be encouraged. It changes people's lives, makes them good teammates. It provides them with leadership skills, and it also keeps them in shape. And I think over the years, the last number of years anyway, hockey in the city of New Haven kind of declined a little bit, just simply because of coaching and because of the team, the Nighthawks leaving and so forth. But I really think that we're taking this back to the day when Murray Murdoch was the coach at Yale University.
Wow. Yeah.
And Lynn Patrick, Craig's father, was the coach of the old New Haven Ramblers of the American Hockey League. And they were in the same city. They were former Ranger teammates. And they got together and they said, why don't we get the kids to play and, you know, and create an atmosphere where they can play? And what they ended up doing was creating what was then called Pee Wee Hockey. And it is the real genesis of youth hockey in the United States. And so if you go back to the early days of what's now called USA Hockey, you'll see that the New Haven community won national championships a couple of times in those early years. And that continued for many, you know, with Lou Astorino and with Art Krause in West Haven and Hamden.
Yeah.
That sort of continues a little bit, but we're trying to promote that a little bit more and get more kids to play and put their arms around this greatest sport in the world. And that's really what this is all about. And we hope everybody can get out there to Orange Hills. Great course. And we'll have a good time. I'm going to be taking the red eye to get there because I'm calling IndyCar Racing this weekend for the IndyCar Radio Network at Laguna Seca. So as soon as that race is over, I'm heading up to the airport, taking the red eye, and I'll be out there and be at the dinner with everybody. So it'll be good to see everyone.
Yeah, July 28th is Monday, emceed by another one of our mutual friends, connections with hockey and all that, our buddy, our pal, Rich Coppola, honoring Nick Nixon and Dan Rusinowski. It's at the Orange Hills Country Club, so contact them. All the proceeds, as Dan said, benefiting the New Haven Police Athletic Hockey Inner City Program, Milford's own Dan Rusinowski. And yeah, Dan, talk about what you do off-season away from hockey now. Before you know it, camps will be open, but I know you do a lot of racing, and I'm a little jealous because I love open wheel, and now with the F1 movie and the great IndyCar series, talk about that life a little, Dan. You know, the drivers and maybe people you encounter there, because that, Dan, as you well know, that's a special kind of guts. Hockey players have guts. We all know that. But when you get settled into one of those Indy cars, wow. Number one, they're really tiny.
Well, there's nothing like it, really. And one of the best examples, of course, is at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway at the end of May. My brother and I had gone to a number of those Indy 500s when we were growing up, and there's nothing like four cars coming in four wide at about 230 miles an hour and nobody moving. It's just incredible. Laguna Seca is a different course entirely this weekend. It's one of the iconic courses in the country, a great road circuit that has the famous corkscrew turn where you basically drop about seven stories and you're making a blind left corner to drop down into that, not knowing what's in front of you. I mean, it really takes a lot of guts to do that. But these guys are great athletes. You know, Santino Ferrucci, who's from Woodbury, is one of the guys that you have to really follow if you're from Connecticut, because he drives for A.J. Foyt's team. And he's somebody that you have to pay attention to for sure, because he's up and coming in terms of his contributions to the sport. So for me, I'm with you. It's open wheel racing for me all the way. I got a chance to do that. All I do is pit reporting. I mean, I'm obviously not doing the play-by-play.
Yeah.
Mark James does a fantastic job of that. But I jump in and help out with the pit reporting, and that gets me right into the thick of things. And it's a good thing to do in the off season when, you know, you're staying sharp and getting ready. Beyond that, though, I'm heavily involved with our 24-hour Sharks audio network. So, we're producing programming and doing all kinds of things.
Yeah. All right, folks, if you want to check out Dan and another Nighthawks legend, as we mentioned, Nick Nixon, emceed by Rich Coppola, check out the tournament coming up July 28th at the Orange Hills Country Club. Go online, go to Facebook, or look up Hockey Night in New Haven. Check it out, the tournament to benefit youth hockey in New Haven. Great to have Dan Rusinowski with us, former radio voice of the New Haven Nighthawks, currently, though, the Hall of Fame broadcaster for your San Jose Sharks. Dan, be good. I'll look you up when you get in town. Take care, travel safely, and hopefully you have a nice time on Monday. Be good, man. Appreciate it.
You bet. Great chatting with you, Paul. Good to catch up again. See you later.
Thanks, Dan Rusinowski. There you go. Milford's own in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Man, this is great. This is like a Netflix series. This is like me watching Watergate all over again. Donald Trump, the White House, Pam Bondi, the Speaker of the House, all about the Jeffrey Epstein case and files, and doing his sworn duty to try and make all sense of this, our friend CBS News reporter Aaron Navarro in D.C. Aaron, what is up with you? This gets curiouser and curiouser every day, doesn't it?
it's a story that doesn't seem to go away despite the president's and the White House's, you know, attempts to pivot to other things and move past this. But certainly more developments have been coming every day since this all started.
Yeah. Now, when last we left our studio audience yesterday, Aaron, we had a judge saying, no, you can't see the grand jury testimony. We had a member of the House saying, we're going to get Ghislaine Maxwell in here. And then we had the big story, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal, regarding, we told Mr. Trump his name is in a lot of these files. So, man, what do we make of that? Or is this just a more twister here?
Certainly, yeah, there's been a lot of developments. I'll start with the unsealing of grand jury files.
Yeah.
You saw a federal judge in Florida reject that premise. There is still an outstanding ask in New York from the Department of Justice and their attempt to get more of those grand jury files unsealed. That is still going through the court process. The judge is still deciding all of that. The Wall Street Journal story, the one that we saw yesterday, was essentially mentioning that President Trump, his name was in the Epstein files. He was told by his attorney general in May that was the case. Again, it is not a full-on declaration that there was any wrongdoing by him, and we already know that the president and Jeffrey Epstein were close in the 1990s, running kind of in the same social circle in New York City, but it certainly ties him again to Jeffrey Epstein, a story that he is looking to get past. In the response, the White House noted that President Trump kicked Jeffrey Epstein out of his Mar-a-Lago club and sometime in the 2000s and said that this was just a continuation of what they called, quote, fake news stories.
Aaron, thank you. Aaron Navarro, CBS News, watching the story that just won't go away. Aaron, thanks. Be careful, my friend. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, there you go. Aaron Navarro there, CBS News. And as one of our previous callers just said, Hulk Hogan, at one time, one of the faces you would see just living his life around the Connecticut, the Fairfield County, New Haven County areas. The great Hulk Hogan, going back to when it was the Worldwide Wrestling Federation before it became the WWE behemoth, passing away at 71, and whether you liked wrestling or not, you knew who Hulk Hogan was. And joining us right now to talk about really a legend this guy leaves behind across all platforms, we welcome from the fine folks at News Nation. Check him out on your TV system, News Nation. Kurt Bardella joins us. Hey, Kurt, good afternoon. Paul in Connecticut, how are you, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
This really, Kurt, I mean, obviously the death of Hulk Hogan, he is on the Mount Rushmore of wrestling, isn't he?
Absolutely. I mean, if you were going to have a Mount Rushmore of wrestling, of sports entertainment, Hulk Hogan is the very first face that you etch, in stone.
And talk about his origins. Terry Bollea, obviously. Anybody now with Wikipedia, we can dig into the origins of this guy. But the climb here, Kurt, from a guy named Terry Bollea, taking on the name of Hulk Hogan, and they say successful people, Kurt, in media and sports, they just have it. And he had it in spades, didn't he?
Oh, he sure did. I mean, you have just charisma jumping off the screen. And, you know, it's so interesting because, you know, when Hulk Hogan really came on the scene, it was a very different time in our society. There was no cell phones. There was no internet. There was no social media. There's no way to become viral overnight.
Yeah.
There's no reason why anyone on the other side of the country should know your name. And yet, through his persona, through his charisma, through his ability to leap off the canvas, if you will, as a larger-than-life superhero, Hulk Hogan was able to mainstream professional wrestling from this thing that had a niche audience, was kind of made fun of, people called fake, to something that was very prevalent in our culture. You know, I think about how cable TV worked back in the 80s. It was new.
Yeah.
Programming was different. MTV had just started.
Mm-hmm.
They started this thing called the Rock and Wrestling Connection that aired on MTV once a week that brought Hulk Hogan right into your living room with the likes of Cyndi Lauper or Alice Cooper. And all of a sudden, you have these new music fans being exposed to the product of wrestling for the first time. You have Cyndi Lauper at WrestleMania 1 that Hulk Hogan headlined. You have Hulk Hogan in Rocky 3 with Mr. T, who he would team up with as well in that famed WrestleMania. And you know, he superseded that sport and grew into this global phenomenon where he's on Johnny Carson. He's on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Yeah. If you've never watched a single second of wrestling,
yeah,
you knew the name Hulk Hogan.
Kurt Bardella, the guest, joining us about Hulk Hogan. Kurt knows his wrestling from News Nation. And Kurt, along with that, though, you needed, in fact, he needed this more in the 80s, as you mentioned, pre-social media. He had the personality. There was something about seeing him, the deep tan, the white Fu Manchu mustache, the bulging pecs. He was, wasn't he like the guy we all wanted to be to some point?
I mean, he had the 24-inch python, the red and yellow, the iconic theme song, you know, I am a real American. And as a kid in the 80s, you know, he's the one. Listen, I can tell you, so many of us, we said our prayers and ate our vitamins.
That's right.
Hogan told us to. you know, so he was, as a kid, he was a role model. And then as you grew into adolescence and eventually adulthood, he was someone that you aspired to be, like someone that you would, you know, I remember, again, as a kid, going to a WWF, you know, live show and sitting through 3 hours of matches just to get to that final 15 minutes to see Hulk Hogan.
And when he came on stage, right, Kurt, and I'm a little bit older, so, you know, I would see that and say, you know what? This is kind of like Muhammad Ali. You know, I would think to wrestling, Hogan was probably as well-known, they say, for a time. Ali was the greatest well-known athlete in the world. I'd say Hulk Hogan was up there with him at one point.
I mean, it wasn't an accident that at WrestleMania 1, the special guest referee while Hulk Hogan main evented was Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
And he would participate in a number of things with Hulk over the years. And I think, again, in an era that was defined by these larger-than-life characters that were bigger than her ecosystem, Michael Jordan, Michael Jackson, Oprah, Hulk Hogan is a name that stands among them during that period of time.
He still looked remarkably good, even though you could start to see it, Kurt, at the end. And I was talking to some people here at the station, and, you know, it's a reminder. Yeah, this may be what they call it, sports entertainment or an exhibition, but guys like Hulk Hogan, their bodies, Kurt, depending upon what they also put in their bodies, you know, everybody knows that, but man, they took, even if these were scripted, man, they took a pounding. I mean, these guys and gals, they take a physical beating that I don't think a lot of people understand.
Yeah, I always took issue when people called it fake. It's not fake. It's real. They are being thrown around that canvas. They are putting their bodies on the line. They are paying the price physically. There's a storyline. There is a trick, if you will. But the physical toll that goes on, I dare anyone who has the audacity to look at these athletes and say what you do isn't real, dare you to take a bump in the ring and then see what you have to say about it.
I would always say that. You go tell these guys and gals it's fake. Let me know what happens, right?
It's like, take one chop from Ric Flair on your chest and tell me if it's real or not.
Yeah. Hey, Kurt, when can we check you out on News Nation? When do you on so my audience knows?
You know, pretty much all the time. There's no shortage of things that we talk about. For once, I'm glad that I get to come on and talk about something that I'm passionate about, like wrestling. But I was just on Colin McShane's show literally 20 minutes ago.
Nice.
Last night I was on with Leland Vittert. I was on Morning in America this morning, as a matter of fact. So catch us up anytime, really. It's just a delight, though, to come on and be able to kind of share some of my own life experiences in tandem of the world of professional wrestling with you all.
All right, Kurt Bardella. Check him out, News Nation and NewsNation.com. Kurt, thank you. Be good. We'll chat down the road. Appreciate it, man.
Look forward to it. Take care.
All right, thanks. Kurt Bardella, B-A-R-D-E-L-L-A. He's on News Nation. Check him out, NewsNation.com. And, of course, on, what do they say? What does the guy with the big voice say? Your local TV provider.